This is Dare to Be Authentic Talk Radio Worldwide with relationship coach, life coach, and author Mari Mitchell, broadcasting live from Southern California.
I'm your host, Mari Mitchell, and I have a very special guest today. His name is Paul Joel. He's going to be talking about his passion for his faith and his novel, A Man Like You and Me, A Supernatural Adventure Story, which is based on a true story. On March 25th, 2019, Paul became one of the fewer than 500 people in world history to get Hashimoto's encephalitis. Large parts of his long-term memory were wiped out, and he had no short-term memory. He also suddenly had diabetes and a peripheral neuropathy. This lasted until 4/29/22, when miraculously and suddenly his memory came back. Welcome to the show, Paul. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Very excited to be here.
Good. I'm excited to have you. So tell us a little bit about your story.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, and The book part where it says about the author is you can take the boy out of Brooklyn, but you can't take Brooklyn out of the boy. Always a Brooklyn boy. So I grew up in Brooklyn, and my parents were Jewish, and they were European Jews who barely survived World War II. So they didn't believe in God. I never met my grandparents, cousins, aunts, uncles. My mother's the only one in her family survived. My father the only one in his family survived. But they worked multiple jobs, and since they worked many jobs, they put me in this torture chamber called yeshiva, okay? And it's, you're in first grade, and you get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and in the morning you learn how to read Hebrew, write Hebrew, the Old Testament, Jewish history, and then in the afternoon somebody comes in, teaches you what you would learn in public school. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've never had this experience of being the dumbest kid in class, but I've had the experience of being dumb, okay, and I remember it distinctly. You're supposed to be able to say two words with meaning when you're one, okay? Usually it's some form of mama, dada, and you know who's who. Well, I was 3 years old, and I wasn't saying any words, and apparently I didn't have a pediatrician, so one of the friends of my parents says, hey, maybe you should send him to a pediatrician. So I was seen by a female pediatrician and then sent to a male pediatric neurologist. And I remember the worried look on my parents' face that, you know, I was retarded. And after examining me, he made the pronouncement, no, he's not retarded. He's aware of his environment. And I didn't know what environment meant. I thought it was a body part, but I knew it was a good thing I was aware of it. He learned to talk. He's just slow. He's very slow. So basically, the diagnosis was not retarded, but dumb as a box of rocks. So it wasn't a surprise going to this yeshiva where I was like the dumbest kid in every subject area. And I get D's, and it wasn't like my parents were running up to see what the problem was. They already knew I was dumb. So this was in grades 1 and 2. Then we moved to a different part of Brooklyn, and now it was worse because now I had to take a bus ride for 5 or 6 miles and the same schedule. Different kids, different school, same result, the dumbest kid in class. And that went on for most of the third grade until Mr. Frank Tandler, who's a character in the book that I use his name, who was the teacher of the public school part, said, I need to talk to you after class. And he said to me, look, I understand, you know, when I call on you in class, you seem to have some understanding of what's going on, but when you take these tests, you're the worst student I've ever had. Don't you study for the tests? So I told him my schedule, look, I don't get home till 6. There's homework in the other subjects. I have to eat something, prepare my lunch, and do the homework. And why should I waste my time studying? I'm dumb. And he said, you're not dumb, and you need to study. I don't care about your schedule. So the next week, in a loud voice, he announces there's a test. And in a loud voice for everyone in that class to hear, he says to me, you understand? I don't want to hear about your schedule. There's a test tomorrow. I expect you to study. Do you understand English, or is English a second language for you? And that really hurt because all the people in that class were, like me, children of immigrants. And, you know, my father really had difficulty speaking English. He'd pronounce Wednesday with Wednesday, with an extra syllable and a V for the W. Mm-hmm. So I studied and got an A. Who the hell knew? And then, you know, the other part of the coin is when I get the answer wrong at these classes, I get smacked over the hand with a ruler. So I got these little scars on the top of my hand. And then I talk my way into public school, and the first year was this teacher who hated little boys. This is fifth grade, and she'd say some really disgusting remarks. It wasn't like just me. She hated all the boys. She loved the girls, hated the boys. I get an answer wrong, and she'd say, "Well, listen, you have to stop thinking with your penis and start using your brain for a change." And I was like mortified with this. And then finally, I got myself into this more to sixth grade, where I had Miss Hammer, who was a blonde. And for the first time in my school career, nobody was hitting me, nobody was embarrassing me, and it was normal. And I think in the back of my head, I was already pre-programmed to think that blonde is wholesome, blonde is good, and people with dark hair like me, some of them are nice, but some of them are terrible. Okay, so fast forward, I'm now an intern resident at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, and the chairman of pulmonary lung disease is Dr. Howard Lyons, a genius, an absolute genius. And he had a couple of mottos. The first motto was, if you know the patient, you don't need the chart. So normally the underling presents the case by reading his note. Okay, so you have three or four admissions. You'd be up all night. And then morning report the next day at 8:30. Instead of reading your note, he took the chart, and he expected you to present without the chart. So most of the doctors couldn't memorize everything on those charts. They would say the labs are normal except for this, this, and that. But I memorized all of them. Like I wasn't like showing off. It was just I had two things going for me. I had this terrific memory that I never appreciated until I got sick, and I had this fantastic immune system that I got from my father that would kill everything. Like, you know, my kids would say, "Dad, how come you never get sick? You know, we come home, you know, from school, they catch something, give it to the other brother, give it to my wife, they're all hacking away, and it looks like I'm not sick." I said, "No, I get sick for about an hour, and then this immune system kicks in and kills everything. But, you know, I'm a human being, I get sick, but it just lasts for an hour." And that I knew, okay, I just didn't realize that the memory was really good, okay? And so fast forward, I'm now a pulmonary fellow at Mass General Harvard because of the letter from Dr. Lyons and because I was a very good resident. And so the first day on the wards, there's, I don't know, seven or eight patients, maybe nine, scattered throughout the hospital that the pulmonary service, lung service, is following. So I get there a couple hours beforehand and memorize everything on those charts, like, you know, thinking this is what was done at Kings County. It's got to be done at Harvard or Mass General. So then I meet Dr. Hales, the attending at the chart rack, and I hand him the chart. And he looks at me like I'm crazy and explains that he's the attending, he's my superior, and I'm supposed to be presenting the case to him, not the other way around. And then I told him what Dr. Lyons said, and of course he knew Dr. Lyons, and I said, "Look, this will save you time. You can go through the chart while I present and write your note now instead of coming back and writing your notes. It'll save you time." So he did that for the first one, and then I hand him the chart for the second one. He says, "You know this one too?" I said, "Yeah, I know all of them." So here's the best part of the story. Finally, we get to the ICU, and there's a patient on a ventilator with tubes coming out of every orifice. And as I'm presenting and he's holding the chart, I see the back of this nurse's head and it's blonde hair. And I remember thinking, okay, the width of her shoulders isn't wide, she's not fat. And then she, suddenly, as I'm presenting, she turns around and I see her face and I stop. I say to myself, "My God, what is this? This is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in the world. What is this doing here, okay, in the middle of all this?" And then I hear Dr. Hales say, "You want to tell me how this patient got on the ventilator? You know we're pulmonary, that's what we're here for?" And thank God I didn't say this, but the next thought was pulmonary. Who gives a crap about pulmonary? Look at this woman. Anyway, we're married 40 years now. That's the first time I saw my wife. So in the book, there are two characters, really, okay? There's the physician who's having these supernatural events, who's questioning his sanity, and then there's the beautiful blonde, who's basically tailored after my wife. And it's kind of a, you know, it's an adventure story, as the title says, but it's also a little bit of a love story. And again, everything in that book, except for one scene where I never saw the Blessed Virgin Mary, okay, that's completely made up. But I'll give you an example. The supernatural events of October 15th and October 16th, 1982, were witnessed by my wife. She was there, okay? She's not in the book at that time, okay? She comes in later, but I'm not going to be taking, you know, we're married January 1982. We're not going to be taking a vacation for 6 weeks by myself without her in October 1982. And so here we are. It's October 15th, 1982. We're in Germany. And of course, up until then, I hated Germans. And again, one of the life lessons of the book is don't hate anyone. Okay, so of course, I get converted in Germany. So we're on this tour to see Neuschwanstein. It's the castle that Ludwig II built in the 1800s before Nazis, okay? And it's the castle that Walt Disney uses as a model for all his castles. It's gorgeous. Anyway, so on the way there, the bus stops in the middle of nowhere, and there's a coffee shop that obviously paid the bus company to stop, and everyone gets off the bus to have something to eat or drink or use the restroom except for me. Across the street is this little church. And, you know, again, I didn't believe in God, but it's nice to walk in. Sometimes these churches are very pretty to look at. So I walk in there, and I didn't know the story at all, but the story is that there was this icon of Jesus being scourged. And it was used in the Good Friday procession, but everyone agreed this is pretty ugly. So they threw it in a barn for a couple of decades until somebody realized there were tears coming from the eyes of Jesus from this thing. So, of course, the name of the church is Wieskirche, or Tears Church, and they put that on the altar. And when you walk in, it's beautifully decorated. It's a Catholic church because the stations of the cross and the walls and the ceilings. It's something you'd see in Italy. Beautifully decorated, except your eye is drawn to this ugly thing at the altar. So I'm sitting there and minding my own business, and then I get this thought. I love you. Your sins are forgiven. And I got converted.
Wow.
And you know, yeah, right, wow. And a little bit like St. Paul on the way to Damascus, okay? And I kind of patterned myself after him in a lot of ways. And again, the front of the book, again, has, of course, A Man Like You and Me, a Supernatural Adventure Story, but it also has the definition of love by St. Paul. Love is patient, love is kind, does not envy, blah, 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 goes on. It always protects, always trusts, and always perseveres. Okay, and again, the book is very short. It's 96 pages printed. Okay, but in print, if you discount the title pages, the chapter title pages, but love is the most important thing for happiness. If you have no love in your life, you can't possibly be happy. It's the most necessary thing. Okay, there are plenty of incredibly wealthy people who are miserable because there's no love in their life. And there are also a large number of poor people who have love in their life and are happy. So it's really one of the essential points. And then the back cover is a picture of a baseball batter. And the reason for that is the baseball batter comes to the plate hoping to get a hit. And more than 50% of the time, he fails. Okay? Even people in the Hall of Fame don't have a batting average of 50%. Okay? And so, like life, there's a lot of situations where you fail, and then you have to walk back to the dugout, and then you have to wait for your next turn at bat and keep trying. Don't give up, okay? So that's kind of a little bit what, you know, I failed so many times in life, but I'm this big sinner, and you know, you have to keep trying anyway. You can't kind of give up with this. So there are a lot of life lessons in that book. It's chock full of that. And again, the purpose of the book was to increase faith in people the same way it happened to me. And again, you know, my life was completely changed that October 15th, 1982. And the next part of that is we're celebrating. So I asked one of the people there, what's one of the nicest restaurants in Munich at the time? And he said, well, the Four Seasons Hotel restaurant is one of the best in Munich. So I said, let's go there. And the person at the hotel we were checking out said, you can't get in there. First off, we had backpacks and jeans and sneakers, and said, you can't get in there with running shoes. He used that term. And you need to have a suit. You need to have a gown. And also, it's a small restaurant. It's Friday night. October 15th, 1982 is a Friday. You'll never get in. So we march over there, and as we walk into the hotel, the person at the front with the top hats looks at us and says, look, let me take your backpacks. I'll give it to you on your way out. Like, basically, we don't allow people dressed like you in our lobby. And then I asked where the restaurant was, and he said, on the second floor. And I get there, and the man, the maitre d' in the tuxedo, asks me my name, and I tell him my name. And there's one empty table, and we ate. Okay, and everyone there has gowns, and the piano player had a tuxedo, And the piano player was playing this song, A Man Like You and Me. It's one of the reasons for the title. And I asked somebody to, if they could write the lyrics. And basically, it's about we're all subject to our fate. And we're all slaves to our fate. And that's one of the places where the title came. And unfortunately, the next day was the bad day, okay? And during that meal on October...
Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and then you can tell us about the next day.
Sure.
We're going to take a break to hear from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
For the mom out there feeling exhausted, overwhelmed, and hopeless, I see you. You are not alone. There is light at the end of your dark tunnel. How do I know? I was you. I'm Carissa, an author and educator. Raising a child with a disability nearly broke me, but I refused to give up. Now I help other moms reclaim their hope and start truly living. Find out how at bravelyintentionallife.com.
Hello, my name is Tamara Miller Davis, and I'd like to tell you about my realistic and romantic novel, Despite the Buzz. It is about technology's influence and other timely topics. There are digital wellness resources in the back, as well as book club and discussion questions. The story is a colorful and artful multimedia piece, which serves as commentary on media's influence. Check it out at despitethebuzz.com.
We're back on Dare to Be Authentic Radio. I'm your host, Maury Mitchell, with special guest Paul Joel, talking about his novel, A Man Like You and Me, a supernatural adventure story that is based on a true story. Okay, so you can go ahead, Paul, and tell us the next day.
Okay, so before we go to the next day, during the October 15th at that meal, my wife wrote down a list of seven things on a sheet of paper with eight dashes, so one was empty. And one of them was Paul, the other Stephen, the other was St. Bridget of Sweden. And they didn't make much sense at the time. Anyway, so the next day we get to Vienna. We slept on a train, get to Vienna. It's evening time. It's time to eat. So I say to my wife, look, let's look at a restaurant on the plaza of St. Stephen's Cathedral because there's a law in Vienna that you can't have a building higher than that so you can see it from everywhere. So let's just memorize how we get there, and we'll look at this restaurant. Again, there was a restaurant supposedly on the second floor. So there's a glass door and with the wooden frame, and there's a light on the second floor, and I walk in, and the light is dim, and clearly everything's closed, so I turn around to leave, and I'm locked in. And again, I'm a Pomeroy fellow from Brooklyn, and everyone knows about the fire in the Coconut Grove nightclub in 1921, where the people couldn't leave and were burned alive. So there's a law in every Western country that you can't lock people in. You can lock the door if the place is closed and nobody can get in and out. But once I can walk in, I should be able to walk out. And I know this. And then I'm tapping on the window, and a nice man with dark hair walks over, and he can't open the door that I opened easily. And now I'm really frightened. And then I turn around and see a few things, which really frightened me more. And then finally, this blonde woman comes to the door and opens it easily, and we run out like scared mice. And the next day, I buy this book of saints, and when you look at July 23rd, the feast day of St. Bridget of Sweden, that's the face of the lady that opened the door.
Wow.
So these kind of, yes, wow. These, and again, this is the list from the list of my wife, okay? And, you know, she's given certain pieces of information, and that day she's also, there was also a map of Munich, okay? This is back into Munich, okay, the day before on the 15th. And when you fold the map in a certain way, it looks like there's a J where the Wittelsbach Fountain is in Munich. So after dinner, we're rushing to this fountain before we get on the train to Vienna. And as we're, you know, rushing there, we both kind of understand this is the name of our first son, okay? And I'm looking to see if there's something written on this fountain, which is gorgeous, of a John or a James or a Joseph or something. And as we're running there, she says, it means James, like as if I'm supposed to know. So I said, you know, well, how do you know it's not John? That's a good name. And she said, it's James, like as if I'm supposed to know this. Anyway, so I'm looking to see to see if there's anything with a J there. And instead, there's a man, an American with a southern accent, little old man, standing there. And again, this beautiful fountain's in the middle of traffic. And he looks at me and he says, "My name is James. I've been waiting for you for a long time. It's about time you got here." And then he turns around and walks away. And, of course, our first son's named James.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, right. Right. So, again, the major part of the book is that the character, my character in the book, is supposed to fulfill the requests of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal in 1917, where she tells these three shepherd children to go to the Pope and have them consecrate Russia to her Immaculate Heart in union with all the bishops. And they do that, and there are two popes that consecrated Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, Pope Paul, and then the Polish Pope, John Paul II. But none of them did it as requested with the bishops. So the character in the book, my character, and me in real life, thinks that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to get the Pope to do this correctly. And what's really interesting for me, anyway, is I wrote the book in 1988, and I mentioned that the consecration is supposed to happen in a church in Moscow. And you think that it would happen in the Vatican because the bishops all meet with the Pope in the Vatican several times a year. But no, in the book that I wrote in 1988, it's in the church in Moscow. And then about March 8th this year, around that time, I was told that it's supposed to be in the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary in Moscow. And they're supposed to bring in this, the real icon of Our Lady Vladimir, for the consecration. And I'm supposed to be there. And again, without spoiling too much of it, what's at stake is that if it doesn't happen in my lifetime, there's supposed to be a nuclear holocaust where all the nuclear weapons in the world just go off. Man created these weapons of mass destruction. Well, the evil one's going to come over and set them off. So billions of people will be dead, either immediately or afterwards. So, again, that's what I believe. I've been called crazy a lot of times, so who knows? Maybe it's just completely wrong, but I don't think so. And that's kind of what the book is all about. So I'm that person in the book. So if you read the book, you know who I am. And unfortunately, if you don't read the book, you have no idea who I am.
Let me ask you a question, Paul. What do you think is the main message that you're bringing to the public with this book?
Well, I'm hoping that, number one, people will read the book and there'll be an increase in their faith. Okay. If you know, I'm hoping that there'll be somebody who's an atheist will suddenly see the light, or there are people who believe in God and their faith will be increased. So there's a spiritual design for this book. In addition to the obvious, as my wife keeps telling me, you need money to buy things. So it'd be nice if people, you know, bought the book and I made some money. But really, if somebody could just bring the book to the attention of their local bishop, and somehow it got to the Pope, it would be a huge success, okay? Because that's what I think is one of my life's goals.
Okay, very good. So let's talk for a second about how the listener can get your book.
Okay, well, there's four places they can get it. They can get it on Amazon, but they have to click in. First, they have to click in books, and then they have to click in the title, A Man Like You and Me by Paul Joel, and then it comes up right then. And it's available in a hard copy, a soft cover, and an ebook also. It's also available on Ingram Spark, on Barnes & Noble, on Kindle KDP. So those are the four platforms where they can get the book.
Okay, fantastic. And the link to Amazon is right here on the Blog Talk page, so you can link right there. You can go to the others as well, but that gives you an easy place to link to. Fantastic. So is there one? We got about 3 minutes left. Is there one last thing that you'd like to say to a listener today?
Well, again, most people think that they're the hero of their life story. In my case, it's clearly my wife who's the hero or heroine of my life story. And as in the book, she saves the day. Okay, and I'm supposed to do something, and the stress gets too much for me, and I freak out. And she says, "Well, you need to put your big boy pants on and do this, that, and this. And if you do that, we'll do this, this, this for you." So she convinces me to to go to do what I'm supposed to do. Okay. Mm-hmm. And in real life, she's been saving me since. I mean, again, I haven't driven the car since I got sick with this Hashimoto's encephalitis on March 25th, 2019. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my fingers don't work and I drop things and I got a peripheral neuropathy. And my son reminded me, by the way, that it actually started on Christmas, the Christmas before in 2018, when I had this flashing lights in my right eye. And the typical response, of the hard-headed physician who says to himself, I can't get sick. Okay, it's part of the defense mechanism of working at a place around sick people. I mean, here I am, I'm an intern and resident at Kings County Hospital. There's drug-resistant TB all over the place.
Right.
People who don't complete a course of treatment. And I'm not wearing a mask. No one's wearing a mask. And in order to function there, you have to have this ridiculous idea that you can't get sick. And I didn't, okay? And so here I am in my 70s, and I've had this terrific good health until that time, Christmas 2018, rather. And I didn't do anything with these flashing lights, and, you know, clearly I was having seizures from this. And then, you know, then I got hospitalized, and I was put on chemotherapy and steroids and anti-seizure medicines. And again, I was kind of like a moron for all that time, and, you know, from March 2019 to April 2022, when suddenly my memory came back miraculously. So I'm kind of spoiled with, you know, miracles, seeing them and experiencing them. And again, the purpose of miracles is to instill faith and to instill faith in people, and that's the purpose of it. So I'm hoping that people will read this book and they'll get some faith too. It's one of the great blessings.
Yes, it's absolutely. And miracles are real, and we can all experience miracles. Well, we're out of time, Paul. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been lovely having you today. Thanks for listening in to Dare to Be Authentic Radio. We're live right now, but a replay of this is being recorded as we speak. So spread this to people that you know that would enjoy the show. And make sure you come with us next time on Dare to Be Authentic. Bye for now.
This is Dare to Be Authentic Talk Radio Worldwide with relationship coach, life coach, and author Mari Mitchell, broadcasting live from Southern California.